The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I want to suggest that trust is a kind of useful rubric through which to think about some issues that we tend to discuss in through other rubrics, privacy, cybersecurity, you know, some other constituents. And this word has a useful place, I think, in the conversation.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, February 22nd, 2021. David Hoffman is Associate General Counsel and Global Privacy Officer for the Intel Corporation. In that capacity, he asked me to convene a group of people associated with Lawfare to study the problem of trust in hardware and software technology supply chains. In his other capacity, that of the Steed Family Professor of Practice in Cybersecurity Policy for Duke's Sanford School of Public Policy, he asked me to give a talk to a group of students about trust and technology development. It's a wide-ranging conversation with David and with the students about what the components of trust really are, how many of them are technical, and how many of them involve other things like corporate governance, like the regulatory environment in which products are produced, and that ineffable thing called brand. In the first part of the conversation, I give some thoughts on the subject. In the second part, David asks a series of questions, and in the third part, I take questions from students. It's the Lawfare Podcast, February 22nd, Trust, Hardware and Software.
The question of trust in hardware and software is one we don't actually often talk about. We kind of talk through it. So it has been a long time now that the US government has been on a campaign to keep Huawei out of our 5G networks. It has been a roughly similar amount of time that the European Union has been fretting about, probably even longer, fretting about Facebook, which is a thing that they couch in the language of privacy, but is really a question of, can we trust this foreign entity to hold the data and exploit the data of very large numbers of EU citizens? It's the question that underlies the anxiety about TikTok. Should large numbers of Americans and others be downloading an app that in a somewhat unclear way may be subject to demands from the People's Liberation Army or the Chinese Communist Party as to how data is used or what is captured and that sort of thing? And I could go on and give you a much longer list. At a domestic, more recent level, it's the question behind SolarWinds, right? A company is widely and relatively unthinkingly trusted and adopted by very, very large numbers of federal agencies, as well as private corporations. And it turns out that trust is rather misplaced. And of course, there are companies on the other side that we all trust immensely without a whole lot of thought about why. So why do we trust Google with a basic diary of our lives, which is what our Gmail is? Why do we trust Apple with what's really more than a diary of our lives? It actually, the iPhone or the Samsung Android version of it is your life to a large extent. And these are mostly subconscious decisions that we make without a whole lot of consideration of what goes into the decision to trust an application, a piece of technology. If you're an enterprise corporation, they actually think about it a little more. An individual, a government, what are the constituent components of trust in hardware and software? Why do we feel comfortable to the extent that we do trusting Apple? And why do we do it if we don't feel comfortable? We tend to debate these issues in language other than trust. As I mentioned before, with respect to Facebook, the European Union talks about it in the language of privacy, right? And most of the time when we say we don't trust a company, we usually use a different language for that. We use language like privacy or security. But I want to focus, for purposes of this conversation, on the constituent components of trust. And you're going to see, I'm not going to mention the word privacy. I'm going to try to talk about this in a somewhat different vocabulary. And so I'm going to talk from the point of view of an unspecified entity. And I want you to think as I talk about this that the entity could be you. It could be a company that is trying to decide whether it would adopt a technology that something may depend on. It could be a government that is trying to understand whether to use the technology itself, or at the more extreme case, permit or discourage the use of the technology domestically. All of these questions, I would submit, they're different in lots of ways, but they all come down to the question of what is trust in this context, and what is trust made of? And that's a question that we don't always ask ourselves in that way. And I think it's an interesting and useful way to think about these questions. First of all, I want to disaggregate the question of trust. When we say we trust a product, that could mean that we have confidence at a formal technical level that the product has been demonstrated to perform the way it is supposed to perform. So let me give you an example of that. There is a series, and some of you have studied these, I'm sure, there are a series of proofs with respect to certain encryption technologies that they work, right? We know what they do, we know how they're put together, we know mathematically what the function will be. And so if the component is produced right, we actually have a formal demonstration that that will work. That's one kind of trust. Now that does not answer a second level question, which is the component put together right? It answers this sort of base level question, which is, assuming we put it together right, Will it perform as we expect? But it doesn't answer the engineering question, have you in fact put it together correctly? That's a second level of trust. Trust that in fact, the formal model has been operationalized correctly. I would submit that relatively little trust, these are actually really, really dramatic bases for trust when you can have them. And yet when you think about the products that you trust, you have neither of those things. You don't say, well, before I buy this iPhone, I'm going to examine the formal underlying math of the various chips in question. You don't have the capacity to do that. Most people don't anyway. And actually very few people have the capacity to do that systematically. It takes a bit of a polymath technically. So what are we actually relying on? And I want to suggest that there are these three or four other levels of trust that we use as varying qualities of surrogate. One is brand. So one reason we trust products is that we believe, rightly or wrongly, that the brand identifications of them designate trustworthiness. And of course, the brands in question actually work on that. So if you follow the Apple-Google wars, Apple's been hammering Google for years now on, we're not a data company, we're a hardware company, right? We secure your data in a way that Google doesn't. And Google hammers back about the security of the way they handle data. They're both positioning themselves as trustworthy custodians, albeit for very different, they have very different arguments for it. Apple's is basically, we're not in the data business and we're really serious about it in the limited cases that we are. And Google's like, yeah, we're in the data business, but we're really good at it. So brand is a big one. But of course, SolarWind was a good brand, right? And that actually was a good brand until the day it wasn't. So that's an imperfect surrogate. The second one that I think is closely related to the first, but is different, is a long track record of something working. So a product or a line of products that has a demonstrated track record over time of not having a lot of vulnerabilities or being associated with a company that is open about the vulnerabilities, problems when they arise and they get closed is, I think, a significant source of trust. So a good example of this is Microsoft. If you talked to people 10, 15 years ago about Microsoft and particularly about Windows, it was considered a major league security disaster. And Microsoft had a brand problem as a result of that. And they developed, in response to that, a very substantial trust building exercise, which involved dramatically improving both the security of the product, but also importantly, the speed with which they addressed security vulnerabilities when they arose. And I think that track record and brand are very closely related, but I think the source of trust is slightly different, although they overlap. One component is, I trust this company. And the other is, this product and the line of products that it is part of has a track record of being secure relative to the other products around it. A final area that I want to mention is circumstances of production. Actually, two areas. I want to talk about them separately. So we have anxiety about products made in China, that at least products made in China that are doing things that are super important. And this is actually a source of mistrust rather than a component of trust. I suppose you could say the component that is trust, the positive formulation of it is, do we know the product to be produced in a circumstance that doesn't undermine trust or that does promote it? But China is an authoritarian government that spies very aggressively on other countries. By the way, the United States is a non-authoritarian government that spies aggressively on other countries. The regulatory climate in China is such that companies are not adequately independent of the government in the view of a lot of analysts, that you can be confident that they are not doing the government's work for it, at least when demanded. This is the source of the anxiety about Huawei and TikTok. And so you can imagine a situation in which You have relatively high confidence in the formal product. You can test the product. The company has a reasonable track record of behaving appropriately, however you define that. And yet you still don't trust it because it is producing a product in a regulatory environment in which it has to comply with things that are themselves a source of a lack of trust. Now, if you think about the European Union's anxieties about Facebook, I have just described the Schrems decision, right? That the European Union or the European High Court says, hey, look at the formal law. The United States has 702. It requires that these companies turn data over to the government. We don't like that. Therefore, these companies can't be trusted with our data. So this is not simply a U.S. anxiety about other countries. It's also other countries' anxiety about the U.S. The difference, of course, is that Facebook's obligations under 702 are in public law and you can analyze them. And the anxiety about Chinese products is that they're not in public law and you can't necessarily or rather that the public law is so vague that it covers a million different things, a million different possible iterations that aren't necessarily stable. So I want to close with the proposition that trust in both hardware and software is a super complicated mix of technical, corporate governance, regulatory, and other factors, including how you feel about the environment that produces the product in question. And so we have been trying to isolate, and this is, we can talk about this in the Q&A if you guys want. We have been trying to isolate what are the constituent components of trust. And if you were, say, a company that was looking, one way to think about this is, what would Huawei have to do to satisfy you that its products were trustworthy? What would you have to learn about TikTok before you could say, all right, I know they're, you know, may have been born in original sin, but they've made the following 20 reforms. And so I am now willing to download it on my phone, which I am not, by the way. What are the components that make up trust for different actors? How should you think about it as a user? How should companies think about it as an adoption and also in their self-presentation with respect to their own products? And finally, how should government think about it? Governments think about it with respect to their own, their acquisitions and their regulatory authorities. And I want to close just with the observation that trust and cybersecurity are not quite the same thing. So cybersecurity is a constituent component of trust. All right, you can't have trust without cybersecurity. But I think you probably also can't have trust without good corporate governance, which is not a cybersecurity issue. And it is possible to imagine a perfectly well-designed product that is nonetheless not trustworthy because of the conditions in which it was produced. And so I want to suggest that trust is a kind of useful rubric through which to think about some issues that we tend to discuss in through other rubrics: privacy, cybersecurity, you know, some other constituents. And this word has a useful place, I think, in the conversation. So I'll stop there and we can take up any part of that that you find compelling or find ridiculous.
And could be compelling and ridiculous at the same time.
Well, could be compelling because it's ridiculous.
We'll see. So let's dive in a little bit on some things that, I just want to tease out some of the things you talked about. A lot of people, I believe, think TikTok doesn't belong in the same realm of some of the other risks that we're talking about, like technology like Huawei that is going into the telecommunications network of countries around the world. Interested, Ben, how do you feel about that? Do you feel that the use of the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, IEEPA, and the Committee on Foreign Investments in the United States by the Trump administration for TikTok actually makes sense? And we have to really think about trust in terms of technology for things like, you know, technologies that children in middle school record dances on.
So, I mean, I am sort of agnostic about TikTok, honestly. I don't love the idea of very large numbers of middle school students and high school students worldwide giving their data to a company that is potentially at the whim of the People's Liberation Army. That said, you know, there is a non-trivial claim that that is not actually what's happening here. And I don't want to stake out a position on how anxious we should be about TikTok. But if you say, let's take the worst anxieties about TikTok as true for the purposes of argument. Is it a good idea for a company, let's just say hypothetically, controlled by the PLA to have large amounts of data about, you know, every middle school kid in the country, in the world? No, not a great idea, right? Like, not, I don't know what they'll do with that, but it's like, I don't think that is a healthy thing for us to be encouraging. So I'm not inclined to, you know, whether IEEPA is the right way to address it, I don't know. And I agree with you that it's a completely different trust problem than, you know, the problem of embedding Huawei technology in 5G infrastructure. I think it's a different problem, but I'm not complacent about it either. I don't think it's a healthy thing. And I think, you know, if you say, my trust level in social media companies in general is not especially high, but if you say, do I trust U.S. social media companies as custodians of U.S. data more than I do Chinese companies? Yeah, I mean, I'm not using WeChat.
So let's play with that just a little bit more. You and other authors, maybe primarily other authors on Lawfare and guests you've had on podcasts have spent a decent amount of time the last 4 years talking about norms and institutions that were eroded during the Trump administration. And yet at the same time, I think we're trying to say, hey, because of our norms and institutions, technology that from the United States should be trusted more. And so you asked the question of what would China have to do for us to be able to trust Huawei and TikTok? What do you think the US would have to do to allow the Court of Justice at the European Union to feel confident that we could trust US technology?
Yeah, so look, I think the real answer in both cases is the same, which is that persuasion is secondary to market dynamics, right? The reason Huawei is doing well, despite the fact that lots of people don't trust it, is that they're a major market player who's been first to market in a number of important areas recently, and they're, you know, producing high quality products at lower than other entities' rates. And the reason Facebook is doing fine in Europe, despite the European Court of Justice, is that they provide a product that, you know, everybody loves to complain about and people also use a lot. And so I think to some extent, you know, it's a sort of form follows function thing. We trust because we use, not we use because we trust. And, you know, I think that's kind of unhealthy, to be honest. I wish that the discussion between Huawei and the United States were more along the lines that we're having now, i.e. what would we have to do in order to satisfy you? And similarly, I wish the, you know, as best as I can tell from Schrems, the answer to on the data stuff from the European Union is you can't, because you're American, American company, and you know, and American law, we don't like American law. Even though, of course, American law is stricter on government acquisition than almost all European countries. The conversation isn't actually oriented around trust. It's oriented on the company's side on market power. You know, you at the end of the day, you'll complain all you want, but you'll use us anyway, because you will. And on the government side, on, you know, some form or another of flailing, whether in the EU, it's judicial flailing, and in the United States, it's, I don't know, executive branch flailing, but it's flailing.
Let's talk a little bit about the flailing a little bit more. You know, one of the things that we spend a lot of time on in the cyber policy classes that I teach at Duke is understanding actually the global nature of the technology infrastructure, and that you're often talking about a stack of technologies, from hardware to software to applications, the services on top, that are assembled from all different locations. We take the best of class of technologies, we combine them together, and then it's created this global digital infrastructure that we have. It feels to me, without a better way to have this conversation around how to trust, and you can see it even, we haven't talked much about China being concerned about trust, but you have it in the Chinese national strategy that they want to move away from using US technology for lots of different functions in the Chinese critical infrastructure and government uses of technology. And so it makes me wonder if we're on a path of what it seems like for many situations to have a vertically integrated technology supply chain stack, that where we would just recreate a lot of technology for each layer of the stack within a country. It seems like we will give up a lot of functionality and a lot of the benefits that we've gotten from integrating technologies from all around the world. But it also makes me wonder what are we going to do for countries other than the United States and China? So take a country like Brazil. You know, if we think of not what the US should do or what China should do, what about a third party like Brazil, and where do they go for their technology?
Yeah, so I think this is the ultimate trust question, right? It's if the United States's position is, hey, you know, we really feel better about trusting technology when we know the Chinese Communist Party has had nothing to do with it. And the Chinese government's view is we really feel better about deploying technology and anything sensitive anyway, that we know the NSA has been nowhere near. That does argue, creates a logic toward a certain degree of, you know, people say Balkanization but I like your formulation of it better. I think it's more neutral, a sort of vertically integrated within countries stack. Now, I think the US is better positioned here than most countries because we have relationships like the Five Eyes relationships, where, you know, when you say the US stack, that'll include the UK, Canada, Australia, New Zealand. China's won't. It'll include China, right? Because other countries, China doesn't really have allies in the way that the United States does. And it certainly doesn't have allies based on values affinity. It does have an immense and quite rapidly developed organic technology development capacity. And it has the ability to not use as much US technology if it chooses to. And the premise of your question is quite right, that Brazil does not have that capacity. And actually India does not have that capacity, right? I mean, there's a lot of countries that don't have that capacity, including some major economies. So I think eventually what happens to those countries is either they have to decide which vertically integrated trust environment they trust more. or they have to develop it, the capacity to do it themselves. And I do think it would be better if we had some mutual vocabulary among the various countries that have stakes in this, which is to say almost all, of some capacity to say, all right, let's have common vocabulary of what constitutes trust. And by the way, we know you're going to do something else for your highly classified systems. We're not really talking about that, right? We're not talking about what NSA is deploying. We're talking about what the Department of Health and Human Services is deploying for its non-classified day-to-day systems, right? And I think we don't even agree about what constitutes trust in that context.
So you went exactly where I was hoping you were going to go, Ben, which it sounds like in that model, if that's our future direction, that we're basically going to be creating alliances, and there's basically a club, the trusted club that participates in doing technology development and working together. Does getting to that end goal necessitate a very different function and set of activities for the U.S. State Department than what was happening under the Trump administration?
Well, yes. I mean, so leave aside that the Trump administration actually had some, I think, solid instincts with respect to China and technology. And so I don't want to be sound dogmatic about this, but if you're trying to create environments of greater shared values for trust, shared definitions of trust, shared understandings of trust, shared senses of what technologies you're just not going to use, like going out of your way to alienate your allies in 100 different areas, having, you know, trade wars with Canada about aluminum is really not helpful. I mean, it's so, you know, there were some valid instincts about China that are not inconsiderable and that we shouldn't, you know, we shouldn't be quick to dismiss in the Trump administration. But, you know, like everything else, if you're trying to organize the rest of the world to confront China, that means working with the rest of the world. And that's something that they just weren't into. And I think, you know, we lost a lot of time as a result of that. And we lost a lot of opportunity. And by the way, we set ourselves back in a big way with respect to a bunch of countries that we need to work with. One of them is South Korea, you know, is a giant player in this space. And they have good reasons to wonder, if speaking of trust, if they can ever trust us again about anything. So, you know, that's a geopolitical thing, not a technological adoption thing, but the two points aren't wholly unrelated.
Yeah, let's extend that and talk about some other countries just from a foreign policy perspective, because it also strikes me that not only was it that maybe we need to make changes from where the Trump administration was, we might need to make changes from some of our decisions and priorities that were created during the Obama administration, and that the Biden administration may need to go really its own way. As I think about it, let me make a statement and then see to the extent to which you agree with it. As I look out in the future, one of the big technology development areas where trust is going to be potentially even more critical will be the implementation of artificial intelligence solutions across a wide swath of different industries. And there's been a lot written about sort of an AI superpowers war between the US and China. And part of that is, can you really trust how these algorithms are operating and what the decisions are being made and how they're impacting individuals? And part of that is also, I think, based on the fact that this idea that because of China's size, particularly its population, but also I think about its way that it does technology development very quickly, that it's going to generate more training data and be more effective. Does that mean that, for example, India might be a higher priority than India was during the Obama administration? Does it mean that cybersecurity is so important that a country that's really prioritized it, like Israel, continues to be a huge priority? I'm just wondering if you can give other ideas other than Korea of countries, whether you agree with my comments about those two countries, and are there other countries that you think the US should really be focusing on in this area?
So look, I think the three that you named are all really interesting in this space, which is why you named them. So, you know, Korea, India, and Israel, well, what do they all have in common? Number one, they have in common that they have a highly developed tech sector. You know, India's is less cutting edge, but it's not insubstantial, and they have enormous numbers of trained people to throw at problems. They are all, I mean, Israel is not especially China engaged, but it's they're not China in the orbit of Chinese policy, and some of them are sort of hostile to it. And they are countries with which we have common vocabulary of what cybersecurity means, which, by the way, people don't understand this, but like when the Chinese say cybersecurity, they mean something completely different from when we say cybersecurity. And, you know, and so part of the question of trust involves this question of whether you're even seeking the same things, right? And I think with the South Koreans, the Israelis, and the Indians, mostly that question is answered in the affirmative. We are, by and large, seeking similar, on the defensive side in cybersecurity, similar things. So I do think that fact will draw us closer. I mean, and has already, and by the way, it's drawn the Indians and the Israelis closer.
Now that's a great point. I'd like to open up now for some audience questions, if that's okay, Ben. Particularly, I think I've got a bunch of student questions already here. Can I turn to some of those?
Sure.
All right. Do you think the failure of technology to enable effective contact tracing in the US was driven by a lack of user trust or Google and Apple's desire to portray themselves as trustworthy?
That's an excellent question. And I think the answer is probably a bit of both. That on the one hand, you had Google and Apple design, and I'm not criticizing them for this, but designing a protocol that was intensely protective. And I'm sort of don't know whether had it been less protective, the product might have been able to be more effective. But it is fair to say, and look, the history of contact tracing apps over the last year is a history of overpromising. And so it may be that the problem is just way harder than people understood a year ago. But I think, you know, Google and Apple, for very laudable reasons, wanted to make clear that they were not going to sanction or, you know, build into everybody's phones a means of surveillance or espionage or privacy intrusion. And so once you had checked all those boxes and made that protocol capable of delivering on that specification, the problem is really hard. So I do think the desire for trustworthiness actually plays a role in undermining the functionality. Now, I say that, I want to stress, I don't know whether it's doable well, like if you ignore all that stuff and you say, screw privacy, you know, I don't care if people don't trust us, I'm happy to be the, you know, Chinese government. I just want to save lives and I don't care whose privacy I violate. Well, I still don't know if you could design a good contact tracing app given that. So I'm not sure they're wrong for making that judgment, but I do think the problem is, you know, designing a contact tracing app that is not untrustworthy in other ways, it turns out to be a very hard problem.
So, Ben, I'm just wondering on that, it also makes me think that the trust got defined very narrowly there. And trust, it was all about not tracking people's location and coupling that with other information, and seemed to lose the whole idea that you can actually trust that this is going to protect you from contracting the disease. And it felt to me we missed the equation didn't end up balancing out in the end.
I think that's right. I guess my only point is, look, I think we, you know, what happened was, you know, someone said the words contact tracing app, and then 1,000 million voices cried up, but privacy, but privacy, but privacy, which was a reasonable thing to shout. And so then you have the incentive is when you roll out your protocol, make sure you've addressed the 1,000 voices that are crying out. And maybe in doing so, you've lost a little bit of sight of the first objective, which was to alert you if you're in contact with somebody who's you know, carrying the virus. And so I'm agnostic about it. I have not really studied the problem of to what extent it got in the way and it was doable otherwise. I will say that their concern on this front was evident at all stages of what they did. And I think the premise of the question, which was that they were very focused on this, and they were focused on this for trustworthiness reasons, is an interesting insight, and I'm sure it's correct.
Hi, sir. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us tonight. I really appreciate your insights. As a national security expert, I'm curious what your thoughts are on, you know, China tends to play the long game in that they have been known to collect data over the years. You think about the OPM breach and some of the other things. When I think about TikTok, I worry about, you know, maybe it's benign right now, but in 15, 20 years, when our kids are older and they're running for office or they're in the public policy realm, you know, how much is going to affect what they did online 20 years ago? So
what you think about that? Well, the way you've stated that question, it's as true of Instagram as it is of TikTok. That is, people of a certain generation put immense amounts of information out there in public and with very little thought to how it's going to affect them socially or professionally 20 years from now. And we haven't really figured out the answer to that question because that generation is still pretty young. But I think underlying your question is a point that, hey, again, if we take the worst case scenario about TikTok, which is that it's a, you know, it's a front for intelligence activity, a la the OPM hack, yeah, it's an incredible data set, right? And it's not just the videos, it's also the metadata underlying the videos. And so now you're saying you're not just, it's not just that the unfortunate drinking video of yourself that your 40-year-old self wouldn't want to be answerable for your 18-year-old self doing. That's a problem that, you know, US social media, you know, we created that as a problem for ourselves. We didn't need TikTok for that. But the problem of the People's Liberation Army potentially knowing everybody who shared that video, who's follows the following 30 people, right? These big data sets over time are extraordinarily powerful, particularly in integration with other things. So now think about, you know, these won't correspond in time well, but cross-referencing against people's SF-86s, which you've stolen in the OPM hack, right? And I don't know what you can do with that stuff, whether it's a, you know, you put a million AIs to work on it and you end up with garbage, maybe. But maybe it's really powerful. And so I guess I come back to where I started, which is I think it's quite different, as David says, from the Huawei question. But am I comfortable with the idea that there is a major social media presence that is being adopted worldwide as the standard for children? No, I don't think that's a good thing.
Thank you so much for talking with us tonight. So my question is about the components of trust that you mentioned earlier. Do you think that these components are only important in technologies that are readily available to the public, or is this in sectors such as defense that have more access to newer technologies? Is the components the same, or do you think the emphasis is on the advancement of the technology over trust?
Super interesting question. So look, it is a question whenever you are considering adopting a technology. The difference between a major defense contractor and you is that they actually have the ability to study how the technology works. And if they're going to adopt or thinking about adopting a technology to do X, they're going to go and do a certain amount of work in those first two areas of trust that I identified, which is, you know, hey, how do we know that this plane's avionics machine thing that we're thinking of using, if you think about that stack that David described, where one piece of technology is being layered on it, how do we know that this avionics component is going to keep the plane in the air? And they're actually going to study that at the level of, okay, what's our formal understanding of what this thing is doing? What is the testing look like about whether it in fact performs the way we think it's supposed to perform? What's our record of dealing with this entity before? And they're going to actually make a certain, at least if they're competent, they're going to make a certain systematic look at that. So if you think about, to give you another example in a less sensitive area, but David works in his other life for Intel. Intel makes chips, it doesn't make the computers around the chips, right? So a lot of you guys have computers that have Intel products in them. Somebody made a decision to use that Intel chip, it wasn't you, right? It was the company that built the computer, made the decision to use that Intel chip as opposed to some other company's chip. That was probably a studied decision, right? It was a decision to say, hey, for our application, based on the things that we know about that thing, and they know a certain amount about it. Now, when you're doing that same process for yourself, unless you are, you know, an applied math person with a real background in hardware engineering, you're not going through that process. And so I think the question is, it's the same question, but it's a very different modality of answering it. You are much more likely to say, well, I've used Apple before and I've never had any security problems. And Tim Cook says he takes care of my data. And by the way, I really like iPhones, so I'm going to buy another iPhone. I think that's more the mode that a lot of people go to. It's some gestalt sense of brand in combination with track record. And it's highly influenced by the branding exercises that the companies go through. So I would say the question is the same. The mode of answering it couldn't be more different.
Ben, we've got another question from one of our undergraduate students that brings up a whole topic of conversation that you and I have talked about before, that I'm really interested to see how you will respond to this question, because it's about another category of mechanisms that would cause us to trust one supplier of technology over another, which would be the corporate governance law within a particular country that provides some level of oversight to determine for that other individual who doesn't have the capacity to evaluate whether that company is going to be accountable for its commitment. So it says, I have a question for how the government can use its regulatory tools to help build trust in companies' products. Are they, for example, allowed to look at the source code of tech companies' algorithms to determine if there are any privacy security violations? And then this is the part that I particularly think is interesting for the conversations we've been having, Ben. Is there anything similar in the tech space to an S-1 form for an IPO that discloses info on a company preparing to go public?
So the answer to that latter question, which is a very perceptive one, is no. You know, now there are two major exceptions to that. One is in the classified space, if you want to get your product adopted for use in classified systems, you got to open it up, right? And the government reserves the right to, you know, do all kinds of testing. And the second is there are regulatory environments. And the most famous recent example of this that I can think of is the British interaction with Huawei, where, you know, Huawei wants in on British telecommunications backbone. And the British, unlike the United States, initially took the view, you give us access to everything, and we will make our own judgment about whether it's trustworthy. And Huawei complied with that and cooperated with that. And it really looked like the British were going to take a different path from the United States. And then a few months ago, they reversed course and they said, you know what? This stuff just isn't trustworthy, and no amount of testing that we can do is going to change that. Now, whether that was pressure from the Trump administration, a come to Jesus moment on the part of the British, bit of both, it's never been totally clear to me what it was. But it is the case that, like, I do think they sketched out a different model, which is, you know, and they tried to implement a different model, which is we will be, as a regulatory matter, we will examine those first two layers of trust in great depth, and then as a regulatory matter, make a determination as to whether this is fit for adoption. And that's very different from what the United States did, which was basically said, ugh, right? I actually like the British model of this. And I think it's interesting that it failed. And why exactly it failed is a really interesting question. Now, as to your question about corporate governance, I think this tacks back in a very interesting way to David's earlier point about what do countries do that don't have an indigenous technology sector that's capable of building a vertically integrated thing. And so the answer, like, if we take this out of the tech space and put it in the, oh, say, banking space, you say, well, everybody trusts Switzerland, right? I mean, drug lords, countries, Nazis, very reputable businesses, they all like to go to Switzerland and do banking. And why is that? Well, some of it is a historical bank secrecy thing, and some of it is a demonstrated record of trust over time. Swiss are, you know, do good banking, and they're part of that is a regulatory environment. Right. And so I think you could imagine a country creating, I don't know which country could do this, but a country creating the kind of ideal regulatory environment for the fostering of trust, leaving aside the question that nobody knows what that regulatory environment would look like. But, you know, imagine Switzerland says, we're going to have the ideal trust fostering regulatory environment for technology. And therefore, the answer to David's question about Brazil would be they buy Swiss products because Switzerland would establish itself as the regulatory environment that you can actually, that maximizes trust. We're nowhere near there being a Swiss banking model of this. But I do think that's an interesting question. The country that could generate the regulatory environment that maximized trust in end products would benefit an enormous amount from it in its export market.
Yeah, and I would say, Ben, that to some degree, for the past 20 years, a lot of our allies have actually depended upon the information assurance reviews that the NSA does of technology to be able to establish. So there are some models around being a trust intermediary also, almost that other people can rely on. I think you're right. I think that's something that we're going to likely see develop, but it's a ways away. Let me read another question. Our are there technology companies that we might trust for a lot of our purposes, like Apple, we might trust to do the things that we do with our iPhones, but we might not trust them with our health data, for example.
Yep.
And how do we create a framework that then takes into the consideration the different contexts of trust?
So the answer to that first question is yes, absolutely. I would totally trust Huawei to build a toaster that I would use. You know, that doesn't give me any anxiety at all. Like, and if you say the company that I least trust in the world, the Kim Jong-un Corporation, right? If they made a hammer, I wouldn't buy it because I wouldn't want to give the North Koreans money. But, you know, if a hammer showed up and it's a single block, right? Like you can actually verify that it's a real hammer. It's not going to do anything else. And so, yeah, context matters enormously. And this is why the TikTok question is different from the Huawei question, right? One is the acquisition of huge amounts of data about teenagers. The other is underlying the internet, you know, backbone in countries around the world. Really different trust questions. And the answer to them has to be contextual. But I think the sources of trust are not actually contextual. They're actually going to be the same. What may be contextual is if you think about aggregate trust as the assembly of different constituent pieces. So in this case, we have a super well-tested product with a good formal structure behind it, and we have a corporation that has a pretty good track record, and by the way, that's invested a lot of money and complies with all of our expectations about corporate governance. But the problem is that that corporation is in, you know, Singapore, which, you know, is kind of authoritarian and, you know, we don't really love its legal system, et cetera, et cetera. But it's not the worst in the world, right? So your trust there is going to be the aggregation of the different pieces of this. And you might very well say, totally fine for X purposes and Y purposes. But, you know, for the part where we're afraid of what happens if the Singaporeans demand something of it, we're not going to trust it for that function. And I think, yeah, these are highly, highly contextual judgments, and they will interact with different fact patterns very differently.
And to me, Ben, I think what's really powerful about what you're saying there is that this, we have the Switzerland of technology trust that's created, and we may find, I know that the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development wants to do a project on starting to describe what these elements would look like. And they serve to some extent as almost a Switzerland-like entity in global public policy, that it could create that model where the elements are the same, but it plays out differently depending upon the trust or the context. Look, by a risk assessment.
And right? In some ways, the U.S. is trying to be this, right? The U.S. argument is, yeah, we demand things of companies, but we don't actually demand things of American companies, you know, in terms of, you know, data production that we don't demand of everybody else as well. And so, and by the way, the demands we make, they're clearly spelled out in our laws, right? And so it's a transparent set of demands that we're making that, and by the way, the companies are free to resist them and, you know, litigate. So there's a judicial system to back them up. I think the United States actually has a pretty interesting case. I do note that it is not persuasive to Europeans. And so I think there are, you know, models that are competing for the, hey, but you can trust us. We should be the Switzerland of technology development. But there's insufficient agreement as to the elements of trust to allow. And remember, Switzerland became this over hundreds of years. It's not, you know, I don't think that developed immediately either. But I do think this is something that developed that will take a lot of trial and error by a lot of different countries to develop over time.
Ben, thank you for coming here and participating in this and being willing to answer so many questions. This has been fantastic. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to the Duke Sanford School of Public Policy for the recording of this event. The Lawfare Podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our promotional director is you, the listener, so get on it, people. Share us on all the social media and leave us a rating or review wherever you found us. Our music is, of course, performed by the one, the only Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.